Welcome aboard. This is Mike.
And Dan.
This is Comparing Apples to Oranges podcast. We take things that are in the same category, but in two different genres, and compare them, contrast them, and tell you which one is better using a set of criteria that we forgot to bring up until right now. This is the first time we're going into hot, guys.
Yeah, well said.
We're going to play it live. Real live.
Fuck it, we're doing it live!
Just like, you know, all podcasts are live. That's what real radio is all about. Dan, what's the category for today?
The category is albums that were released posthumously by artists.
Non-Latin speakers out there, posthumous means what?
After they be dead.
That's true.
And so these are actually the first albums that came out right after these two artists passed away. You know, a lot of times you'll have like albums come out afterwards that are just kind of like compilations.
Greatest hits.
Yeah, or for example, like with, I assume that in the next few years there's going to be a lot of Prince stuff that comes out, because apparently he just has like a vault of stuff he's recorded and never released.
I thought the vault was just stuff that he liked.
I mean, he probably got all kinds of weird
that
shit
that he recorded at Paisley Palace that he didn't let out.
He's got like full like music videos that he shot.
What?
That he's never even released. He's just a weird guy. And I think that, you know, probably the estate of Prince will, in, you know, when they run out of money from his residuals, that they'll probably, you know, try to make a quick buck at, off of that. Tupac has come out with like 10 albums since he's been dead.
Strong.
But he's still alive though, so I guess that doesn't count.
Bad example, guys.
But I think like the thing that differentiates those types of albums from these is those were not necessarily recorded as albums.
Right.
They were just like extra material that they had recorded over the years that they decided to just throw together.
Like B-sides, live stuff, underground tracks that never made it out.
These were actually recorded as albums.
They both were planned to be released at a certain date.
Right.
All of the songs had been taken care of, like mixed and all that stuff. Well, the majority of them did.
Yeah, majority of them. And they just, the artist just happened to pass away for a variety of reasons, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Right.
And last actual studio album that was recorded as an album, you know, with the, we talked in the past about how sometimes albums have a theme or they tell a story or something like that. So this would differentiate them from just throwing together random extra tracks that people had recorded and vaulted.
All right, so let's go ahead and discuss them. We've got Janis Joplin's Pearl, which was released in 1971, and she passed away that year at 27 years old. She was part of that 27 club, which is so tragic. Familiar with Janis Joplin? She was like on blues, soul, rock and roll scene during the 60s and 70s. More in the 70s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, she died in 70, so I guess more in the 60s, I guess. A key player in the Woodstock experience. I don't know how big of a role she actually played, but whenever anybody thinks of Janis Joplin, it's like in bell bottoms and like those weird like sunglasses and a tie-dye shirt, like belting it out on Woodstock stage. She had a serious drug like addiction, and she ended up overdosing on heroin, and we're probably going to get into that story a little bit, but this was her fourth studio album, and it was released a little more than 3 months after her death, so it ended up reaching number one on the charts. So some of that, I'm sure, was like the media flair of the day. They're like, oh, you know, you got to pick up this, you know, album from this talented artist who died too soon. But it was also an incredible album. Like, she really put a lot of good work into it. Her story is very sad, just in general. Like, her upbringing, her, like, talent, like, what she was able to do with all of, like, her singing ability, where it got her, the people she surrounded herself with, all of it was, like, pretty toxic. And I was reading a lot of the Wikipedia history about the album, and it just sounded like the drug overdose was caused by, like, she was clean for a little bit, and she, like, was in a hotel room, and she got sad because this person she was engaged with never called her back or something, or there was some hostility or miscommunication, and then she got in contact with somebody she used to get heroin with, and she took too much, and it was just real, just so sad. Janis Joplin's always held up as one of the people who, she was like the Amy Winehouse of her generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's kind of tragic that we had to have a second one of those, where it was like someone who so clearly in their music talks about how their life is spiraling out of control and no one does anything about it. And Amy Winehouse's posthumous album definitely did not have the same sort of attitude as this one. This, hers sort of seemed to be carted out to make her estate money, which is way sadder, I think.
Yeah, I think they're just, you know, especially, I think the reason why they kind of talk about them both in the same vein, because I really don't think that as performers or as artists that they were on the same level. I think, you know, Janis Joplin is, you know, many stages ahead of Amy Winehouse. But I think just by virtue of the time that we live in and the fact that all news is so easy to get your hands on and, you know, social media is so prevalent that when somebody does pass away, it's a bigger deal than when it would have happened, I guess, 40 years ago, if that makes sense. You know, if Janis Joplin had been around today and had passed away at that young age, I think it would have been, you know, a much bigger blow. Not that it wasn't, you know, a huge blow back in, especially for, you know, her fans and for that generation. But I think that's why somebody like Amy Winehouse gets kind of put up in that category when she might not necessarily have the body of work or even the same, you know, musical talent that somebody like Janis Joplin had or Jimi Hendrix or Jim Morrison or, you know, somebody like that. From everything I read, it just seemed like it was almost like a Kurt Cobain situation where, you know, it's, I don't know if she ever really expected to be that popular. And
definitely didn't know what to do with
it. Right, exactly. Like she, I mean, just didn't, you know, the way to deal with that is to kind of tune everything out. And a way to tune everything out is through, you know, recreational drugs. And then when you, you know, head down that path, there's more often than not, it's difficult to come back from that. You got this, you know, wonderful album right before she passed, but who knows what we could have got if she would have stayed with us.
Right. And on a cheerier note, we have the second album, Life After Death, by Notorious B.I.G. Looks like it was released just less than 3 weeks after he was shot to death.
Mm-hmm.
It was just his second album.
Yeah.
Which I had no idea. It is a two-disc. Is that what you call it?
It was two-disc.
I don't know if that... Yeah.
Because I remember buying the thick packet from...
It's like the double VHS.
Best Buy, yeah.
It was apparently going to be named Life After Death, and the second album that came with it was going to be called Till Death Do Us Part. Did you find that in there?
I did not see
your research. They later shortened it to Life After Death, which makes a little bit more sense with the whole, the album cover is him standing next to a hearse,
right.
And you're like, wow, that's very clairvoyant. That's the wrong word.
I know the word you're thinking of, but I'm not smart enough to to pull it out
predictive?
Of my brain.
Predictive? That's wrong. Anyway, I'm like, oh, they must have seen something coming. And then you listen to some of the album, you're like, nah, they didn't.
Yeah. And, you know, the first album was called Ready to Die.
Yeah.
And it kind of...
And Suicidal Thoughts was on that. And it's just, you know, another... Yeah. You're getting a lot of stuff from these people.
Uh-huh.
They're shipping a lot to you.
You can tell that there's a lot under the surface
right.
that you don't often get to see. Especially with somebody like Biggie, who,
right.
you know, you think is like this indestructible king of hip-hop.
Who was 25 when he died,
uh-huh.
which is insane.
Uh-huh. When you said that you were surprised that this was only his second album, is because he's put up there as top five, top three rappers of all time.
And,
you
not,
know?
And that's not
Mount,
even...
Mount Rushmore of hip-hop.
Right. That's not even to mention like how important he was to establish what actually became modern rap and hip-hop. Like taking out of context his rapping and his hip-hop singing, is that what you would call it? His hip-hoppery? Is like, is still like top tier, even out of time, even out of context. Like, within the context of there was a lot of garbage rap at that time, and of course his is going to be better. It's like, no, his music still stands up. Like, there's a lot of good songs on his double album that is better than the majority of stuff on the radio right now.
Right. And
looking at you, Lil Wayne.
You know, the big thing that was going on, you know, back in the mid to late 90s was that big East Coast, West Coast rap feud.
Which I did not understand. Why are the people on the West Coast angry? What do they have to be angry about? People on the East Coast are mad because, like,
it's like cold half the year.
Well, it's also like systemic racism has always, you know, like, they're rapping about life on the streets. And then, what are they? It's too sunny in L.A. What do they have to be upset about?
There's a water shortage there.
That's recent.
You can't water your lawn. You know, everybody's lawn's brown. Stingrays. Yeah. You know,
these are your problems.
Yeah, this is my problems that I've run into in my California travails.
You're like, I'm not a huge fan of the Dodgers, I guess. They're having a pretty bad year.
I mean, taxes are high.
But I legitimately don't understand.
Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor for a while. All right. That's weird.
We're getting into some weird stuff now.
I'm just trying to, you know, give the people some idea of why the West Coast people would be so upset. A lot of these guys came up together. Like, Biggie and Tupac were actually friends growing up. Oh. She's listening from the other room and dropping little anecdotes. Guys, so thank you.
You'd be able to do this too if you listen to us live, guys. Okay? Just saying.
I told you we have people running around here getting us information. Little did you know that it was my wife. Apparently plastic bags are banned. You can't use plastic bags in
California. I want to shoot someone because of that, but I'd shoot them a dirty look. I'd be very upset.
I might shoot them. Just in the leg or something.
That's what happened.
Plastic bags are, they're great. I think they're great. And I never recycle them.
There's also a East Coast, West Coast hip hop rivalry Wikipedia link that you can click on if you go to the Life After Death Wikipedia page. Just a heads up. I did not click on it. I had things to do that day.
You were pressed for time.
I was running out of time.
But I think, you know, a lot of that stems from the fact that when friendships go awry, if you don't wash it quick, then it just kind of stews. And I think the fact that a lot of these guys that ended up splitting off into the different coast, you know, recording studios, they came up together and they were familiar with each other, and then stuff happened along the way. And so I guess it wasn't really so mad at the coast of the country, but the people who resided on that
coast of the country. That's the thing, is we know that Tupac and Biggie were friends, you know, had professional respect for each other, but that doesn't mean, like, the people that they surrounded themselves with, who might have, like, carried something out. Like, if we follow the conspiracy theory, you know, it's like, oh, this was a reaction to it. You're like, but they didn't dislike each other. Like, he was really sad that that happened, that Tupac was murdered. He didn't, there's no way they would have.
Yeah, and I think that
would get in their head.
P. Diddy, Puff Daddy, Sean Combs, Sean Diddy Combs, Sean
Dirty Diddy Money?
Dirty Money.
There's one we're missing. You remember? They used his song in Godzilla, the movie with Matthew Broderick.
It was great.
You do remember it.
Better soundtrack than a movie. Yeah, that's an example of that.
That's a pretty good movie.
No, it's not. It's not. So
folks, we need you to call in.
We're gonna take a pause here and work this
1-800 apples
before it turns into a East Coast, West Coast beef. That's probably what started that whole beef between Biggie and Pac. They were arguing over whether Godzilla was a better soundtrack or a movie.
Here's the thing, is it was Godzilla 2000, so it definitely wasn't what they were arguing about. But I mean, look at Jay-Z and R. Kelly. I mean, like, if you get big enough, your ego gets in the way of you being an artist.
Tupac used to always talk about how, like, Biggie used to sleep on his couch and stuff like that. And I don't know if there's something to the fact that one of them felt ungrateful toward the other, or who knows what goes on in the minds of...
They were young men who...
Street rappers.
Were like, yeah, they lived... They became popular because they talked about how violent their lives were. So, I mean, like, it's easy to take that in a negative direction, you know?
But, like, you were talking about how Biggie was upset when Tupac got shot. A lot of people pointed the finger at the Bad Boy Records crew for... But it was most likely gang related.
Yeah.
Just the fact that there are, you know, something with his record label, not right. necessarily the other record label, because, you know, Suge Knight has been to Notorious. Jail many times. Yeah.
Held people outside of windows. Yeah. I mean, that was the premise. That's why people wanted to get signed by them. Yeah. That's why they sold records.
Yeah. He's been jailed many times for assault and
conspiracy.
Yeah. Conspiracy, commit murder and things like that. But Puff Daddy kind of came out after all this, and he kind of took over that Bad Boy label as a artist and kind of took it in a different direction, more fun type of hip hop and away from like the street,
like party club rap.
Yeah, it's more like we go to the club, we got lots of money,
like pop,
that's
models.
Why we're cool. Yeah, rather than, you know, we're tough and we're gonna kill the other
right.
crew.
I sell drugs, sort
but,
of
because
attitude.
I think he kind
of
saw that writing on the wall there is that this was a venture to make money,
right?
You know, the beef between the two crews, I think it was more about monetizing whatever beef there was rather than actually keeping the beef alive. And mm-hmm. I think once Tupac died and the other Bad Boy crew was upset, and then after Biggie died, you know, his best friend,
right.
I think he decided it was time to kind of take it in another direction. And he became more of the mogul rather than the guy who was the head of a rival rap label.
Which, good idea to mention that the supergroup, The Commission, did you read about that? Or did you just know about it because you're like into that? So it was Biggie, Jay-Z, Lil Cease. Don't know who that is.
Yeah, I know Lil Cease.
P. Diddy. Back then he was just going by like Sean Combs. Charlie Baltimore. Don't
yeah.
know who that is.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it was like, it was those guys, and he mentions them on the tracks What's Beef and Victory, which I don't know if I've heard Victory. So that's kind of cool. Like, they were going to be another Wu-Tang Clan, effectively. Uh-huh. Biggie's death sort of fractured that.
Yeah, I think there's a line in one of the songs, I think it might be in Victory, where it says, in a commission, you ask for permission to hit him.
Don't look at me like I know this.
You don't like me, hit him, and wild wifey was with him, something like that.
I believe you.
There's a lot of kind of their crew. There was so many guest artists on this album. It's like every song literally was featuring,
right.
featuring, and, right. and there was Lil Kim, Bone Thugs and Harmony, Too Short, R. Kelly, P. Diddy, 112. So many on this album. Janis Joplin's record was recorded with her band, you know, just her Full Tilt Boogie band.
Which she played with them, and she sort of brought them up with her.
Right.
Which is really cool.
Right. And I think this was it the first time that I read that they recorded with her?
Like, I think so. That well, was like her, as a studio, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, in studio, the studio, for sure. Because I know that's who she toured with.
Right.
I think I read somewhere that was the first time that they had actually gotten in the studio together, recorded an album. And there was even...
cut an LP.
put it on, press it on wax. There was one song on the album that was all instrumental.
Yeah, Buried Alive in the Blues.
And that's because Janis Joplin had not put down her vocals on there before she had passed away.
Yeah.
And I think they said that the guy who wrote it, they offered him the opportunity to sing on it,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't feel, you know, comfortable doing that.
Yeah, that would have been weird.
So it just ended up being an instrumental track with Full Tilt Boogie. It was an interesting listening, especially with the diversity between the two albums.
That's why I thought this was a really good... well, it's not going to be a good episode. God knows that, but...
No, it never is.
I really appreciated that, like, these two things are in the same category, but they're so, so different. Like, mm-hmm. the people themselves couldn't be more different, except for the fact that they died tragically young because...
Yeah, and, like, almost the same age, and just...
both. I mean, they're both very just violent deaths.
Skyrocketing, like, going out, blaze of glory.
Right.
Both of them just, you know, the candle burning out too quickly, whatever,
right,
you know, metaphor you want to use.
Yeah.
Their music couldn't, like you said, couldn't be more different, but just the fact that they burned brightly, you know, right before they burned out.
Right.
You know, burned so brightly that they burned out.
So you're welcome, audience, for that, I guess.
Yeah. There's a lot. We dropped like 10 metaphors in there. burn the hands worth.
All right, you ready?
In the bush.
Most of the time.
Yep.
You ready to talk about our criteria?
Sure.
All right, let's do it. All right, we're back. We've got some criteria for you. We've got, because it's songs, we of course did re-listenability. We're going to also tell you our favorite and least favorite tracks from both albums. We're going to say which album we thought had the artist going out on top, or sort of like ending on a good note. Of course, not that they, you know, that they passed away, but this album's sort of a worthy legacy that they left behind. And then we sort of looked into which one had less filler on it. Dan, you want to sort of describe that? Because I thought you put it in a really succinct way before.
Sure. You know, I was reading something about how the length of a CD was, like how much data a CD was going to hold, originally was determined by the length of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
So, that's my metric for everything.
Yeah.
That's,
it's like, how long am I going to work out? Well, how long is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony?
Should I wear a jacket outside? How cold is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony?
Yeah, how cold was it when he recorded?
How cold was it?
So
I think he got pneumonia, so pretty cold.
I think you're thinking of William Henry Harrison.
Go on.
President for 31 days because he got pneumonia.
And that's how long a CD is.
Yes, it's not true. But basically it's, you know, ever since the CD was created, and that kind of became the standard for albums, you know, taking over the place of LPs and cassette tapes, which cassette tapes varied on how much data they could use based on how much tape was in the on the roll. But CDs, a lot of people decided their albums based on, it wasn't the music that determined how long an album was most of the time. Like sometimes you'll have like there was one Weezer album I listened to that was like 32 minutes long.
Yeah, they're really into that.
there's like, we're gonna get in and get out and we're gonna leave a lot of extra space on the CD. So like maybe you want to put like your own tracks on there.
That's not how it works. I looked into it. It does not let me record.
We're going to leave you some space on there. Yeah. You know, maybe if you want to, you know, record Beethoven's, half of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
The best half.
Yeah. Of course, we all know what the best half is.
So there's no really need to say it out loud for
let's
everybody.
Say, let's just say it on the right at the same time. Is it the first or the second half?
One, two, three. Front half.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody wants that back half.
I was waiting to see what you were going to say.
It's all sloppy.
Yeah. I've never heard it. All the way through.
I'm sure you have.
All the way through?
That's a CD length. I'm sure you
have. Yeah, 70 minutes?
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot, man.
I don't know.
That's a lot.
All right, so that's less filler.
But we were talking off air about how artists feel compelled to fill up 70 minutes a lot of times.
I think it's presumptuous to say the artist does. Yeah. I think whoever's selling the record...
You think it's the record label or the...
Well, I think it's more often than not, that's who I would put it on. Yeah. Just because they want to... The premise is the artist is putting out their best work. And if they're like, I wrote 8 really good songs, they're like, no, you need 10. And they're like, no, I spent 3 years writing these songs. I'm not going to come up with 2 in like the 4 months that I'm in the studio. I don't know. That's in my head, that's what goes on.
You see a lot of that too when they release like deluxe editions of albums. Yeah. And they're like, all right, well,
Japanese import,
you know, we'll give you what you want and only put 60 minutes. But that's with the understanding that 6 months from now, we're going to do the deluxe version and we're going to put 4 live tracks on there or something like that to try to make more money. So I think a lot of times they did that. I think they did that with like Taylor Swift albums and Elk.
Hers is definitely a power market move. Like she knows what she's doing. But yeah. I know what you're saying where it's like, oh, we're going to have like a remix of this same song from the same artist that's like a couple tracks away.
And I think it probably depends, you know, like you were talking about the record labels. It probably depends on who the artist is.
And who the record label is.
Right. Like if it's somebody, you know, that's got a lot of pull, an artist that has a lot of pull in the industry, they can probably kind of do what they want. Or if they're like
Beyonce.
Or if they're like a big fish in a small pond, you know, like a, you know,
like a real big fish.
Yeah. Is that
sell out? Okay, it's everybody doing ska, and it's the only ska song people
know.
Yeah,
that's the only one I ever reference.
It's pretty good.
When I think of ska. It's
Cheer up!
It's not bad.
Oh, that's the second song. That's 2 songs.
It's not bad. But, you know, if you're somebody who's like Real Big Fish,
yeah,
who's, you know, just huge power players in the music industry.
No, like they have an entire song about, they're like, no, we're just gonna sell our music to the record label. We're gonna do whatever he says. No more flipping burgers. Yeah. That's the song. No more silly hats.
Yeah.
Man, let's talk about Real Big Fish for a little bit.
You can.
I didn't know I was this passionate.
Fast forward 20 minutes, because we're going to spend the next 20 minutes talking about Real Big Fish.
If I'm lucky, it's going to be the next 20 years.
Wherever we're at. We're going to try to fill up this 70-minute CD.
If you want to hear more about Real Big Fish, tune to my podcast. insert hilarious name.
Reel in Them Fish.
Oh,
with,
no.
With Mike Bono.
Fishing. Oh, yeah. That's the right word of the word, reel.
Fishing with Mike Bono.
Fishing with Dynamite. That used to be a show on KDHX.
Yeah, you should call that Fishing with Dynamite. A look into the story career.
A 3-hour Real Big Fish adventure every week.
That'd
be so much.
I would join for 2 minutes to talk about Sell Out and how good of a song that is. And then I said, all right, guys, see ya.
I'd have you once a week so we could just do that. All right, let's focus up. We still have, okay, so, and then the final criterion.
I keep not finishing.
That's what she said.
Yeah, I know.
You walked right into that, brother.
I did.
Okay.
I backed right into it. Artists sometimes feel compelled, like you said, or maybe forced by the record label to fill up a CD, or in Biggie's case, 2 CDs.
Yeah.
How much on there feels like filler, like just taking up space, or mm-hmm. sometimes they'll even put, like, you know, like Biggie, you usually had monologues
yeah,
on his
skits.
And
yeah.
things like that. Fuji's album, The Score, had so many little like comedy
yeah.
skits.
Kanye
like,
had that on College Dropout.
Yeah, it's almost like, well, no, we're not going to do any more music because we're happy with the way the music comes out, but we'll do these little interludes or whatever to appease the record label or make the fans feel like they're getting more for their money.
And sometimes it fleshes out the, like we were talking about, the arc of this.
Yeah, sometimes it actually, you know, could contribute to the theme or whatever the story, but we're going to try to pick which one had less of those, you know, filler tracks or filler spots on there and was more just about the music, the good parts of the music, rather.
So our last criterion is sort of a tough one to put into words. It's which one, and thank you, Dan, for being a living thesaurus, or someone who's alive who used a thesaurus for me. The word we were looking for earlier was prophesied. So which album sort of foretold this, like, bleak ending? Which one sort of talked about that, the candle burning at both ends mm-hmm. sort of thing? Oh, no, you were saying bright candle.
Yeah. So, something about a candle, some metaphor, euphemism about a bright candle. Candle in the wind. That's what it was.
Aww.
That's what it was.
He's still alive, thank God. But the song's about, Norma Jean.
Yeah.
Too sad.
And then the one about Princess Di.
Yeah.
Which he put very little effort into.
Mailed it in.
Yeah, he did.
All right.
He's like, well, I need a song, you know, because Princess Di, you know, passed away. And they wanted me to, you know, perform, so.
Because I'm technically a knight.
And I'm a musical genius, you know, a music writing genius. However, I'm not going to put too much effort into it. I'm going to take an existing song, change the words a little
bit. Just a little bit.
And sell millions of singles.
Just enough singles.
Millions of singles. So, you know, as far as looking, because these albums were both recorded when they were both obviously going through some shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's dive into this one first. Let's talk about this criterion. Pearl by Janis Joplin mm-hmm. talks about, like, her first couple songs are just about how all of her relationships with men were very, not even negative, just like toxic, and they always demeaned her and called her mean names. She wasn't a very, like, traditionally attractive woman, but apparently people felt very comfortable calling her mean names and ugly and, like, all this terrible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Besides all of that, just garbage. She also had to deal with... So was she engaged, or was it just like a significant boyfriend that she had before she passed away? Do you remember?
I thought it was just somebody that she was...
Chris Christopherson.
I thought... And who actually... Big name songwriter in his own right.
Yeah. Which was... And that was a cover of... Chris Christopherson wrote Me and Bobby McGee, and she covered it. Which is just, like, the song people think about when they think of Janis Joplin.
Yeah, her most famous
song. Which is so
song.
Cool. But I mean, like, so she, like, even though she was in, you know, a serious relationship, she was still just plagued with all this baggage of how terribly people had treated her, which is so sad. And, like, that comes out, and you're just like, but you're, you know, you're so famous, and you're so popular, and you're singing what she wanted to do. It's so sad that she couldn't not move past, just like recognize that she didn't need to be beholden to that anymore. I thought that was really sad. Mm-hmm. And you feel that in her stuff. For a white East Coast woman, she does a great job of singing the blues. You know what I mean? And a lot of that came from not her so much grabbing someone's coattails and just like stealing their music style. It's like, oh, nope, she's, you know, lives through some stuff. She can, this is definitely her singing about these things instead of someone writing it for her. And that voice, oh my gosh, whenever she, like, it sounds like every single time she sings, it sounds like it's going to be the last time she sings for a week, because mm-hmm. she just belts it out, and she's got that gargled smoker's voice, mm-hmm. and she's just like really putting her all into it, like, this is the last time I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, and it seemed like she had really kind of came into her own on this album.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything I've read, professional reviewers and things like that, always kind of the overlying consistent theme that I've heard them talk about is that this was like her most polished album.
Mm-hmm.
And this was where she really kind of put everything together. Not that the other albums weren't excellent, but this was the one where she kind of matured as an artist and kind of
came into her own.
Yeah, like, was more confident about herself as a performer, despite the fact that she had a lot of uncertainties about herself too. You know, obviously, anybody who ends up overdosing on recreational drugs and killing themselves obviously has a lot of stuff going on inside and a lot of demons probably. She seemed, as a performer, I think a lot of performers can probably use, you know, music and making music as an escape or like as, you know, kind of a therapeutic thing. And it seemed like that she, when she was performing, and, you know, if you go watch videos on YouTube, her on YouTube, just how into the performances she was and how, you know, comfortable she was with the musicality part of her life, it seemed like everything else was, you know, very erratic. So it was, like I said, you know, Pearl was, when you look at what happened afterwards, you know, you kind of listen to it in a different vein.
Right.
Who knows how we would look back on the album had she continued to, you know, produce music and lived a long life.
Just like, oh, that was her dark time.
Yeah.
And she came out of it.
Right. Right. And a lot of artists have that, you know, where they, you know, kind of come out of that and, you know, reinvent themselves and can kind of look at the progression of them as, you know, an artist and relate it to the progression of them as a person in their life. But we never really got to see that so much. But from, you know, everything that the so-called experts, you know, say this was, you know, her most polished album as an artist. So
now let's talk about Life After Death. First of all, name works out. Just, they're playing that very well. You know, the cover, album cover has him standing next to a hearse. You're like, okay, very well planned. And some of the track titles definitely lay into it too. What do you think? What's your take on how predictive this was?
I kind of get the feeling that Biggie kind of knew that the road he was going down with as intense as the rap feud back in the 90s, God, it was so, it became very gang centered and very gang related, which leads to even more violence, uber violence, and that's not violence from Uber drivers.
Then I'm gonna have to disagree with the following comment.
But you know, just the fact that, God, you don't hear stuff like that anymore.
They literally have a song. Are you familiar with this? That the Drake and Meek Mill beef. Did you hear about this?
No.
So there's,
I try to follow today's hip-hop as least as possible.
One artist on... Do you know who Rick Ross is?
Yes.
Okay, so Rick Ross has a label called Maybach Music, and Meek Mill was sort of one of his proteges at the time.
Okay.
And Meek Mill was currently dating Nicki Minaj, who was just, like, insanely more popular and probably way more talented than him.
Yeah.
So that's the premise. And you know who Drake is?
I do.
Degrassi.
Yeah, okay. The Canadian actor.
Yes. So at one point, Meek Mill, like, sent out an angry tweet towards Drake. And Drake responded by creating an entire, like, slapback song. And the song was insanely popular. And everybody's like, oh, you just got told. But in the song, Drake's like, I guess trigger fingers have turned into Twitter fingers. And with that, like,
is so
self-awareness, everybody's like, you know what? Drake won this one. Yeah. He's like, no, it's not a thing to win.
Yeah.
It was on Twitter, and now I'm making money.
Yeah.
He's like, and Meek Mill, to this day, I have no idea. Well, I never really knew much. I only knew that one song by him, and that's
He's working on his response.
Still. So, this is 2 years ago.
Leave him alone.
But
it's coming, and it's going to be good.
That's the thing, is like, there's a reason that it's not around anymore, and I'm glad that nobody's dying, but oh boy.
Yeah.
It's also like, we don't have good music.
Yeah, so. See, that's the thing, is that it made the rap in the mid-90s, and I used to think that it was just because that's when I was a teenager.
Which is when you listen to popular music.
Right. Which you look back fondly on your teenage years and you associate music. You know, I listen to like the 90s station on Sirius because it makes me feel nostalgic for when I was younger and had, you know, no cares in the world.
Right.
And no bills to pay. And
you knew which side of the East Coast, West Coast battle you were on.
I was firmly on the West Side.
Is that right?
West Side?
All right. I'm definitely East Side.
No, I stayed in the middle, whichever one was winning.
I'm a very fair weather gangster fan.
Yeah, I'll bandwagon whoever's winning. Whoever's got more guns.
Where's Nelly in this? Where does he fall on this? Where did the St. Lunatics fall
on? I think that's when Nelly came onto the national scene in the late 90s, which would have been
2000s.
A couple, 3 years after P. Diddy kind of led this new
rap form. Renaissance.
Yeah, well said.
I'm pretty sure that's on the History Channel.
That is
like that's right after
rap Renaissance.
Right after
with old white man. I was in my old white man.
Right after Earth Aliens or something.
We need an old white guy to host this on the History Channel.
You need to wear a bow tie, and it cannot be ironic.
You need to sit in a
lawn chair.
No, I was going to say in a study, in a leather chair with a pipe. And
Masterpiece Theater?
Masterpiece Theater? Are we still talking? Are we talking about bad hip hop still?
Masterpiece. Zing. Total. Oh.
Masterpiece. That's what it should
Shots
be called.
Fired.
It should be called Masterpiece Theater, hosted by Master P.
On I don't the think we can Channel. Pull him.
You think he's too busy right
He's on A and E right now. He's got a 10-episode contract.
God, talk about bad hip hop. Man, I couldn't get into any of the No Limit. It was just...
If you played me 10 songs, I don't know if I could pick out Master P.
He was the one I was going, ah!
So that's...
Ah!
Instantly, I think, Ja Rule or DMX when you do that voice.
No, Ja Rule was more... I was talking to my wife about this the other day where... And Aziz Ansari had a stand-up about where he talked about he'd have like this lady like J-Lo, like just beautiful voice, and then Ja Rule would, you know, come in... It's murder. try to sing along with her. Like, let's get this like the best sounding female voice we can have. And Ja Rule, we want you to harmonize with them. And which kind of leads me to some of the stuff on the Biggie album.
Yeah.
Where we were talking off air about when rappers try to become crooners.
Which who no. Come on. Nobody's trying. That's not true. Some people who are good singers try to do rap. So okay, wait. So who won that one?
Which one was it?
Foretold a Bad Ending.
I put Biggie.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Just because like all the albums, like I thought they did an excellent job with like talking about. They had an interview at a radio station.
Mm-hmm.
That listening to that broke my heart.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to die, and
you're
nobody till somebody kills you. Like just, I know that the actual songs themselves don't reflect the same story or narrative of his passing. They did such a good job of prophesying what might have happened.
Yeah, I mean, there was Last Day, Long Kiss Goodnight, and My Downfall, and might as well just like had a song called Somebody About to Kill Me.
Or, you know... Maybe he had an album called Ready to Die that this was a sequel to. Who knows?
You know, Bullets in My Body.
Right.
You know,
this car is driving right next to me. I am very forlorn.
Death by Drive-By. Just you know, if so you just want to get very, very literal. With Janis Joplin, you can go back after the fact, you can go back and look and say, oh, okay. You know, I could see she was like,
but it's not,
she was going it's not through the rehab some stuff.
Song no, by Amy Winehouse. No. I'm not going to go to rehab. Yeah. You're like, what? Hey,
you're going to die if you don't go to rehab.
There's not a lot of alternatives here. So
hers is more nuanced. I think with Biggie was more like, I think he knew, like, I think this is the thought I was, that I got off track with, as we often do on here, but I think he kind of knew the level that beef was, because it was so intense between the two. And I think the reason why it became so intense is because the gangs got involved, like the actual gangs, not the people, you know, not the artists who play gang member, the actual gang members who, that is their life, that is their family, that's how they get by from day to day. They got involved in this. There was so much death that not just with Biggie and Tupac.
Reactionary death.
Yeah,
too,
but there was just so much death in the streets that fueled partially by this music beef between them. And I think Biggie kind of knew he wasn't going to live a long life.
Right.
Not that he was looking over his shoulder every day, but I think he kind of knew that he probably wasn't long for this world. I doubt he knew that it was coming shortly after this album got released, but when Tupac had been shot several times already and survived it, and it just got more hateful and escalated, and they were both making more money, so that means more people were buying it, you know, that means more people were getting influenced by this. I think he kind of knew
also
that the writing was on the wall.
I don't know if you read this, they were talking about, they recently released the coroner's report on Biggie, and they said the first three shots he would have survived, and it just so happened that the fourth shot like hit major organs, and so he would have died of sepsis, but it also hit his heart, or like something like that. So it's like if the drive-by was one shot less, he would still be alive, which he would have survived rather, because he wouldn't have, like, they were just in his leg and he wouldn't have bled out in time, so, which is just crazy.
And the thing is,
which goes back to what you're saying.
I mean, you just got to imagine, like, that even if that attempt hadn't have been successful, that how much longer would it have been, after that?
There would have been retaliation and retaliation for that.
Yeah.
So.
And then people still talk about how, oh, no, it wasn't gang related that killed Tupac. It was, you know, it was Biggie. It was Biggie and Puffy. Like, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Multimillionaire Puff Daddy wasn't in a car with. You know, the only one who would be stupid enough to actually be a part of that would be Suge Knight.
And he was, like, serving time at the time, so he couldn't have done it. So perfect alibi.
It couldn't have been him. He's like, I was in jail, man, for doing the same thing to somebody else. I think, like, with Biggie, like I said, I think it was pretty, to me, it was pretty clear that he kind of foretold, you know, bad things coming, because he kind of, in real life, saw that bad things were coming.
Right. Okay. Let's move on to the next one.
Let's do Going Out on Top.
Okay. Which album had their artist putting their best foot forward for their final act?
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. You want to go out on a... It's like athletes usually stay in the game too long, you know.
A la Michael Jordan.
To where you don't see them at their peak.
Right.
You know, they always, you know, think that they can do a little bit more. But, you know, as the years go on, just like with athletes and musicians, too, you know, as you get older and as time goes on, the quality of your work has to diminish at least a little bit.
Well, I'm pretty sure Bob Dylan just won a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Dan.
Yeah.
And I think, like, we're all pretty upset.
But, I mean, like, when I saw Paul McCartney live,
right.
I mean, he's in his 70s.
Was he doing Wings?
And he was doing everything. He was doing Wings stuff. He was doing Beatles stuff that he had wrote or he had wrote with John Lennon.
Yeah.
But the fact that he sounds amazing for somebody in their 70s.
Yeah.
Nowhere near the early Beatles days or even, like, first, you know, couple Wings albums.
Yeah.
You know? And then, like, as his solo career went on, I just became less and less interested in, you know, the new music he was putting out.
Yeah.
You know, it's like play the hits, because hits are when you were at your best. It's just inevitable a lot of times. You know, sometimes artists will mature, but they mature up to a point, And then there's got to be like a law of diminishing returns, you know, after that. So both Janis and Biggie died so young.
Right. With less than like 5 albums under their belt.
2 for Biggie. That's crazy. You know, especially, you know, where he's at in the lexicon of hip hop and rap. But who did you think had the...
I went with Janis on this one.
Yeah, I did too.
Because it's really good. Like, yeah. She puts every track is... She's leaving it all out there.
Mm-hmm.
And scraping it together to do the next track. I think we get this even more in a concentrated version when we hear the live songs that are on there too. Like, there's a couple live tracks, and they are very evocative, like, electrifying. You feel her throwing all of her energy into the audience, into her performance, which is really cool.
I guess I just thought that as a record, it seemed like, you know, the band, this was the right studio band for her to have that she probably should have had all along.
Right.
You know, she was, forget who she recorded her other albums with. It was like the Cosmic Blues Band or something like that, or that was one of the groups that she worked with. It's almost like she kind of had to try some different things until she finally got, you know, the one that worked out the best.
Right.
And I think that just kind of the marriage of Full Tilt Boogie Band and songwriters that she had on there, and me and Bobby McGee, Chris Christopherson, who's an excellent artist and songwriter in his own right. You know,
definitely.
He was with the Highwaymen. I just think that, you know, everything, like the perfect storm of everything for her.
Right.
Whereas I think with Biggie, I really like both of his albums, but I can't really tell you decisively which one I like better.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked Ready to Die, and I really like Life After Death. You know, I bought both of them like when they came out.
Right.
But I can't really tell you, you know, definitively which one is a better album. But I think that I can tell you without a doubt that Pearl was Janis Joplin's favorite, my favorite album by her.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I picked her for, you know, going out on top.
That makes sense to me. All right, what about Less Filler? Which one do you think was a tighter ship?
I tried not to go just on the fact that Life After Death had more songs on it because it was a double CD.
Right.
I tried not to judge it, you know, solely based on that. But I did pick Pearl as having less filler. Just because there wasn't really any songs other than the instrumental didn't really feel. Half Moon, really, I wasn't really feeling that one. That was the one that had like the congas in it.
No, yeah, I know.
and I think it kind of felt more like that one could have easily have been an instrumental one too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seemed like she was kind of just along for the ride on that one. The Biggie album, for every 2 songs that I really liked, there was one that I was really had no desire to listen to anymore. And we were talking about some of them.
Yeah.
And we both agreed that our least favorite song...
Definitely. Playa!
Playa!
It's so...
Playa! Turn your head round. Lay on the ground. You've been round. Wait.
Not only is he bad at singing,
take off that crown.
Just like, don't, man.
You've been robbed.
Why are you?
Wake up.
You know the whole song, don't you?
Take off your shoes.
I don't know.
And they always got somebody in the background singing their asses off. Take off your shoes.
There's like 3 of them. I think there's 2 or 3.
Yeah.
Backup singers.
And you see where Ja Rule got it from. It's murder.
Okay, so I said that Biggie's had less filler for the following reason. Because as a second album, I think he was trying new stuff. I don't think it was...
Like singing?
Actually, yes. Okay? Just because it sucks doesn't mean that it was filler. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I appreciate that...
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
It's very popular in rap albums. Like, to this day, I mentioned Kanye, but that's like... Oh, God. That's probably over 10 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But Kendrick Lamar's, like, To Pimp a Butterfly, the one that just, like, went multi-platinum and, like, went all that stuff, like... That has skits in it. It has, like, an intro and, like, interludes and stuff. Like, that's pretty common. Mm-hmm. And then, like I mentioned, the interview, I really liked that. And then it was just, I don't know. Even the crap songs were just him trying something different. Or yeah. him pulling in, you know, people who he wanted to give a chance to. Mm-hmm. So I guess, like, I was a little bit less wowed by... There was only 10 tracks on Janice's, on Pearl.
Mm-hmm.
My Baby and Cry Baby seemed... very similar.
I don't know what you could could say that.
Then there were three live songs. Like yeah. I had no problem if it was like 10 songs and two live. Yeah. But I mean like 30% of the final, and then immediately after Pearl was released, I think they did like a greatest hits in like 5 years later, and it was just, it was like just the song that'd be a whole other episode of greatest hits where it was just basically Pearl. You know what I mean?
We did an episode like that with...
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. That's a whole other episode. Yeah,
whose album was that?
Young MC.
Young MC. He just released the same album.
With fewer tracks.
Minus a few of the tracks.
Fewer tracks.
As a greatest hits album. So I see your argument, and I respect your argument.
Whoa! No, you don't. You're using respect wrong again, Dan.
No disrespect.
I really respected the hell out of that burger. You're like, nope, that's not respect.
As long as you preface it with no disrespect, or don't take this the wrong way. You can say whatever the hell you want. I guess I just saw it as more of a ratio thing. Mm-hmm. Where,
oh yeah,
I guess with Janice's, there was like four songs I really liked mm-hmm. for every one that I didn't. And for Biggie's, it was more like 2.5 to one or something like that.
I understand.
The thing about the Biggie album, I always use the my dad and I always use the Songs in the Key of Life argument, which is the Stevie Wonder double album.
Okay.
Which is like 1977, something like that. An excellent double album, but would have been an amazing single album.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
If there was not a lot of stuff, but there was enough stuff on there that you could have done without that would have made it, as a single album, maybe would have been one of the greatest albums of all time. It still is considered, like, one of his, you know, best albums.
Right.
I think the same thing kind of, the argument kind of goes with the Biggie, you know, double album here. This could have been, you know, as a single album, could have maybe been the best rap album of all time, arguably, you know, the best rap album of all time. But I think there was enough, I guess the guest spots kind of threw me off a little bit too, because if you think that, you say that almost every song had a, you know, guest spot on there. That kind of takes the percentage of what each song is him down a little bit, too. But I see your argument, too. I still love you.
Oh.
Even though I disagree with you.
And on to our...
You're a piece of shit.
On to our final one.
No disrespect.
Oh, well, thank goodness. Re-listenability.
Uh-huh.
I gave it to Biggie.
Me, too.
All right, man.
Me, too. I guess it's just the fact that...
it's more fun.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you could like, and maybe for me, that's kind of, I feel kind of biased, the fact that this came out when I was a teenager.
Yeah, it's the same with me and Janice, though. You know, like.
You are 50 years old.
I had her on my Walkman.
You had a.
Team Bobby McGee. That was Cher, sorry. I got a little. That'd be a pretty good cover.
You've been here in life after love. That's exactly what it sounded like.
No, yeah, nailed it.
So
pitch perfect.
Yeah, love Cher.
Love Shaq.
Yeah.
The basketball player.
I like Sonny and Cher. Aww. Not too big on Cher. Actor, as an actress,
you're a big Moonstruck fan.
Yeah, I love Moonstruck.
I kind of thought that...
had, you know, upbeat stuff
on it. Joplin's Pearl was more of like, took it out of you.
Yeah.
Like, it was, like, I love rock and roll, I love soul, I love blues music. But I was just like, ooh, now I'm tired. Like, that was...
emotionally draining.
And then I'm like, you know
Biggie's
what?
Like, he's just like, this guy.
I think I'll listen to Hypnotize.
Yeah.
Like, or, you know. Like,
these guys suck, and they got little dicks.
The Ten Commandments of crack.
Yeah. You know, I've always followed the Ten Crack Commandments.
I know. That's why I brought it up. In my
life. You know.
Because they rhyme, so it's so easy to remember them.
You know, you never...
tap into your own supply.
Yeah, never go. You never get high on your own supply.
You never have family get involved in business.
And that goddamn credit, Bet it. You think a crackhead paying you back shit, forget it.
Like, these are pretty reasonable. This is, like, definitely common sense.
Yeah.
So
he put a lot of thought into...
He got burned a lot, too.
Yeah.
You know?
He put a lot of... You know, he learned from your mistakes.
Or
and
you
then
get,
you come up with these commandments that you have to follow
but
for slinging
like,
rocks.
It's kind of a weird choice to, like, put in a song because everybody's going to have, like, a strong tide rises all ships. Is that the phrase? Strong tide, big tide.
High tide?
Oh, that's got to be
high
it.
High
tide. That's how tides work, right?
Yeah, like, all ships, like, rise
yeah.
with the tide.
Thanks, so, crack like, commandments.
Yeah, even the little punk-ass ships.
You know, Billy on the corner.
Yeah, little bitch-ass ships.
All right.
Yeah, but it's like Biggie's just like, you know, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's a bitch. I fucked his girl.
Yeah.
You know, and I can get down with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun
because,
to listen to.
You know, because I can live vicariously through him
as a
you know, a middle-class white man who's never done crack.
And when, or sold it.
Or sold it. Or, you know.
Cooked it. Right.
Banged anyone's bitch.
Right.
Or laid spray.
Sprayed
you
lay.
Into,
that's when you throw Lay's potato chips at people. You've done that before.
I have done that.
Yeah.
I have done that. And I've also, like, seen how many I can, like, you know, fit in my mouth at once.
Yeah.
Lay's chips, that
oh,
is.
Oh, boy. but, I mean, like, if you try to live vicariously through Janis Joplin, you're like, oh,
like,
man.
Well, I want to kill myself.
Why does everybody keep treating me so poorly? I sing so well.
Yeah.
Or Biggie's like, I'm really fat, but doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Fuck your bitch.
Does not matter.
I think Tupac even had a song where it started off. He liked to make fun of Biggie's weight.
Yeah,
quite a bit. He goes, "That's why I fucked your bitch, you fat motherfucker." Like that's kind of mean, but
rude.
You know,
rude is what it is.
You know, he has a thyroid issue, so
and he eats a lot. So
he eats 30,000 calories a day and
doesn't
exercise. So you
trigger
know,
finger works.
So yeah,
a strong muscle.
You better watch out.
Gat gat gat.
You better watch out because that fat ass trigger finger is pointing at you.
So, what was your least favorite song on Biggie's album?
Playa Hater.
Yeah, it was the worst.
Yeah, it's terrible.
I mean, I could. There was a couple that I wasn't enormous fans of, like, but that was like show-stoppingly bad. Like, no, I think that's it. I'm just comfortable saying that was the least.
Yeah, it is. I'm trying to find like some other ones that are kind, you know, just to for sake of argument.
Yeah.
The reason I didn't really like "You're Nobody Till Somebody Kills You" is for the same reason where he was.
I like that.
You had a good voice. I spit phrases that'll thrill you. You're nobody till somebody kills you. You're nobody till somebody.
I just thought it was a good song.
You're nobody.
But I mean, like, he's just like, he's singing tonelessly. Where the other one, he's like,
we don't even need to drop in any music on this because we've sung so much.
I wasn't a huge fan of Nasty Boy.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of dumb. Bring down south. Threw that back out in the parking lot. Buy a Cherokee and a green drop top. And I don't stop until I squirt. Jeans, skirt, butt naked, it all works. You nasty boy, you nasty. You nasty boy, you nasty.
It kind of reminds me of the scene in Office Space where Michael Bolton's playing the Ghetto Boys, I think, in his car. And
he
just
rolls the window up, locks the door, and then starts mumbling the song.
Just because an African-American gentleman is selling flowers. So he's thinking, like, uh-oh, you know, I'm in trouble here. I better lock my door, roll up the window. And he kind of slinks down his seat
right.
and goes to a whisper. And then as soon as he walks away, I got this killer up inside of me. I can't talk to my mother, so I talk to my diary. I guess that's always been like kind of a, you know, a point of contention, but a point of uncomfortability.
Yeah.
You know, as a white guy.
A white boy.
White man listening to gangster rap
right.
is the their predilection for using the N-bomb.
Yeah. It keeps it theirs. You can't take this music from me.
Yeah.
You can try.
Like, listen, man, I'm not trying to take it from you. I'm just trying to buy an album, bro. I think Aziz was talking about that with Chris Brown.
Yeah.
He goes, just here for the tunes. Don't care about all the other stuff, man. I'm just here for the music.
All right. So what was your least favorite song on Pearl? We'll get rid of the bad stuff first and then end on a good note.
I guess throw out the instrumental one.
Me too. I said that was my least favorite just on the premise that it was...
Yeah.
She wasn't on it.
Yeah, and I'm don't think that's really fair.
I think it's fair they put it on there.
Yeah, I guess. I guess it would either be that one or Half Moon.
Yeah, Half Moon wasn't too strong. Yeah. But I just took...
Oh, you're sweet love home to me.
It seemed like the band was kind of taken over on there, and that was kind of Janice's opportunity to kind of, you know, catch her breath and maybe go get a coffee or some heroin or a heroin coffee.
I need a little pick me up and some coffee.
I need some coffee and a heroin.
Oh,
stat.
No, that's so funny that we both thought. Okay, let's talk about our.
Don't hop on the H train, Janice. Please.
It's too late.
It is.
All right, let's talk about our favorites. What was your favorite Janis Joplin Pearl song?
I mean, I guess it, for me, it kind of has to be Me and Bobby McGee.
Yeah.
Just because it's just so...
so good.
So timeless, you know, and it still holds up, and...
I pull my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wiper slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew.
She just sounds like, I mean, she just sounds so good on it.
Yeah.
You know, just that, like you said, that kind of like raspy, you know, kind of voice that was really different than a lot of the artists were doing then. And I know the song wasn't even written for her.
Yeah.
But the way she kind of took that song over.
Mm-hmm.
And made it to where it's so synonymous with her now.
Yeah.
You know, just that to have the ability and the power to take a song that wasn't even written specifically for you or specifically with you in mind, and to say, I'm taking this over, this is mine, I'm going to make it so.
And that's,
you know,
how history remembers
anybody
it.
Else that does this song, it's Janis Joplin's song. So I guess I kind of had a hard time veering from that as my favorite song.
I went with Mercedes-Benz. Mm-hmm. I really liked that one. I thought it was like, you got to see that she was a good singer. It was like just like really raw. Mm-hmm. Sort of like tells a little bit about her life and like the crap that she went through. But it also just had like a country, like bluegrassy tone to it. So it sort of reminded me of like that 70s folk revival with like that, like Dylan and Johnny Cash sort of spearheaded. Mm-hmm. So I really like that one.
Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz.
Yeah, I think that one.
It's sort of like playful too.
The things I kind of read, you know, when the reviews for the album, you know, people talk about like the track, their favorite tracks and their least favorite tracks. I think a lot of people were kind of surprised by that song because it seemed like whenever you have something that's more like a cappella, it could kind of seem like that's more of a filler.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't.
Right.
You know, it was really, it showcased her. You know, it kind of did more than what you thought it was going to be. I know, like, Boys and Men would do that on their album sometimes where they would, we don't really have instrumentation to go with this song, but if we just have you guys sing an a cappella on there, you know, people will like that. It just seems like it's kind of just put in there just to kind of fill out the album. Whereas that one, you know, could have been construed as that originally, but that really showcased her and it kind of made you... wonder where she could have gone had she made another album.
Because I think she just threw that one together. Like, while they were recording, she, like, went over to a bar, came back with that song.
Yeah, you're like, oh, shit.
She's like, the band's not here. She's like, that's fine. I'll just sing it.
Yeah. And you're just like, well, shit. Who knows what, how she what else she had in her bag of tricks that we never got to see.
Right, besides heroin.
Yeah.
So.
It was full. I tell you, the bag of tricks was full of heroin.
Sucks.
But there was other stuff in there, too. Yeah.
Turns out.
Never got to see it, though.
All right. Because
it was buried under the heroin.
And let's end with our number one Notorious B.I.G. Life After Death song. What was yours?
And there's a lot of good ones on there.
There's, like, some timeless ones on there. It's talking about timeless.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of them. Like, Hypnotize is... Don't think shit, stink, pink gators.
My Detroit players, Tim's for my hooligans in Brooklyn. Easily, I didn't know that was called that.
Yeah.
And then I listened to it. I'm like, I've heard this. It's in like one out of every 15 movies.
Do they ever actually say Hypnotize?
I'm sure they do. I just don't pay attention very well. I mean, like, it's such a weird thing to pick up on. Like, why would you call it that? Come on. Biggie, 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 can't you see? Sometimes your words just hypnotize me. And I just love your flashy ways. Guess that's why they're broken, you're so
fake. Biggie, 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 can't you see?
I didn't read all the lyrics, though. So
yeah, that's the one that's probably most well-known. But,
More Money, More Plums.
Oh, yeah, yeah, with Mace, dollar sign, M-A dollar sign E.
Ma, E dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dollars.
Fuck that guy. Now, who's hot, who not? Tell me who rock, who sell out in the stores. You tell me who flop, who cop the blue drop, who jewels got blocks, who mostly don't you down. But, I mean, there was a lot of good ones on there. When we did the R. Kelly, Jay-Z collabo episode, I talked about how I think that's when R. Kelly's collaborations are really at their best, when he's kind of just singing the hook.
Right.
I think Fuck You Tonight. Mm-hmm. You know, as ridiculous as that, you know, sounds, it's, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's both those guys, you know, at their best.
Yeah. Fine, like a wine
face Rolex, you just shine. I like that waistline. Let me hit that from behind. I think the one that kind of, for me, that kind of flies under the radar, because it, when it came out, Bone Thugs and Harmony, East 1999 Eternal, is like one of my favorite, top 10 favorite albums of all time. That's when they were at their peak and kind of doing something in rap that nobody else was doing. The Notorious Thugs song, I think.
I picked that too!
Yeah.
That's insane!
I don't think that gets a lot of, it never got like radio play.
We forgive you, for you know not what you do. 7 a.m. woke in the morning with Henny caffeine and green and nicotine. No dose, so pop a double of dope that I ripped up. Nigga, Mr. Clean, make it clean. Deep in my temple and I do get sentimentally shamed.
Oh, is that right?
I don't ever remember hearing it like on the radio.
I mean, this is the first time I heard it.
But, you know, and a lot of the Biggie stuff didn't get radio play just because of how edited they had to make it. You know, right. I always joke that, like, it would sound like you were losing reception. You know,
just for tracks of time.
Yeah, you're just like, shit. You go into the repair shop. He's like, my radio's not working.
Yeah.
It's not working. You know, when I listen to Biggie, he says three words and then it pauses for 10 seconds and he says three more words.
Right.
And I guess it...
I don't even know what R. Kelly's saying. I didn't even know he was on the album.
I think that one was... that one did get some radio play. And it was like, I'm loving you tonight.
Yeah, that is.
I'm loving you tonight.
That sounds like a different song.
Instead of... Man, I'm thinking of the McDonald's, I'm loving it.
That's gotta be.
But man, Notorious Thugs is really good because I think you kind of get to... There's no way that any rapper can keep up with Bone Thugs.
They're not supposed to.
Yeah, but this is where you really get to hear Biggie kind of, when he, this is the You don't really get to hear him rapping that fast.
He doesn't have anybody to do that with.
Right.
Or to compare himself with. So
but he showed you that he can do that.
Yeah. Like, Juicy is like him just going at a, like, he set his metronome super slow. Uh-huh. And it's great, you know, great. But this, you're like, oh, he can go very quickly.
Uh-huh.
He does a very good job. Yeah. Like, it's still, like, articulate and smart and fun to listen to.
Yeah, and he kept up, you know?
Yeah.
I think on the other side of that, like, when Tupac did a song with Bone Thugs, he just decided he was going to go at his own pace for his verse, you know? All the Bone Boys, Lazy Crazy, Wish, Flesh and Bone. I always ask my brother who the name the Bone Thugs, and he always ends up naming the Seven Dwarfs. He goes, Sleepy Bone, Dopey Bone.
Lazy Bone's probably one of them.
Lazy is one of them. That's why Crazy, Lazy Crazy, Wish, and Flesh, I think.
Man, Wishbone would be the worst. Although he tells the best stories because he's a dog.
That was a good show on PBS. Little Jack Russell Terrier. As I got my little Jack Russell just laying behind us. Can't hear what we're saying because he's deaf.
And he doesn't subscribe to the podcast, do you?
Comet!
Oh, his eye moved.
That's because he's in REM sleep. Comet!
Oh.
Oh, a little bit.
Nah, he's back to sleep.
But, man, I like 10 Crack Commandments, as silly as that is.
It's funny.
It's good.
Rules to the shit. I wrote me a manual, a step-by-step booklet for you to get your game on track, not your wig pushed back. Rule number uno, never let no one know how much dough you hold, cause you know the cheddar breed jealousy, especially if that man fucked up. Get your ass stuck up. Number two,
I also appreciated on Notorious Thugs that they drop like a Wu-Tang Clan reference and they talk about cash rules everything around me.
I'ma tell you like a nigga told me, cash rule everything around me, shit.
Cause I did not know that they were contemporaries. I got the Wu-Tang Greatest Hits album because I'm a cool boy, and I just never knew when all that stuff came out, and I'm like, wait, they're referencing that in this? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty cool. Cause Notorious B.I.G. is like often quoted. Like, there are other artists today have songs that just pull, not even like the people who are doing like DJs taking his stuff and mixing it over like modern like pop songs and stuff, but they'll just, you know, take some of his lyrics because they're so evocative or timeless.
I liked I Got a Story to Tell too. Maybe just because he has a reference to disappearing like Arsenio on there.
Make a nigga wanna eat that. I'm fucking with you. The bitch official though, dick harder than a missile, yo. Try to hit it and she tripping, disappearing like Arsenio. Yo, the bitch push a double O with the five.
Topical?
Yeah.
But
you know, just straight out of today's freshest today's
from
headlines.
The headlines.
That's right.
I think I said headlines.
You got your mind on some limeritas that you're gonna have after this after we record this.
Yeah, it's seasonal.
But, I you know, there's just so many good ones on there. It's, I guess I like Notorious Thugs.
Yeah.
Would be my favorite.
That's crazy.
You know, Hypnotize is the one that gets the most, but I guess maybe because we heard that so much, you know, maybe I think, that can kind of wear on you a little bit. Had I been around when Pearl came out, might not feel the same way about it,
right,
me and Bobby McGee.
Yeah.
But the fact that I hear it every once in a while on the 70s station, I'm still intrigued by it. I still want to hear it. I still won't turn it off.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if Hypnotize comes on, you know, I've heard it before. But if Notorious Thugs comes on,
very unlikely.
It would have to be, it's not going to be on like the 90s station. It's going to be on like the Backspin or,
right,
you know,
Deep Cuts.
You know, one of the hip-hop channels or something like that,
yeah,
where they will play something like that didn't get radio airplay, but probably could have and should have.
All right, so we're going to close up with, it turns out Biggie has the most votes, so we decided that Life After Death was the better posthumous album over Pearl by Janis Joplin. And we'll be back in just a moment with our recommendations for posthumous albums. All right! Welcome back, Dan and Mike.
It sounds like you're like about to do like a sports talk show. Sports chat with Dan and Mike.
This is Sports Sauce. Sporting on.
That sounds gross.
Right.
I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in.
I'm going to enter a laser sound now.
Pew, 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 pew. And then a fart sound.
That's a fart
just
sound.
Just because we're like so cool. We're tough and cool.
We're way too cool to not fart in public.
That's right.
We're going to give you our recommendations for an album released posthumously, so after the artist died. So my recommendation is called American Six, Ain't No Grave, and it's by Johnny Cash. So Johnny Cash did this insane thing where he just went into the studio and recorded a crap ton of songs. And these are the ones that, if you did not grow up on Johnny Cash, this is your first introduction to him. And I don't know if you've watched movies in the last 12 years, but like one out of 20 movies is going to have one of these Johnny Cash songs, like either in the trailer or during the credits. And we just, both Dan and I saw the movie Logan today, mm-hmm. and the trailer uses Johnny Cash's cover of Trent Reznor's Hurt, which we've talked about that before. That song shows up in movie trailers all the time, and then it had When the Man Comes Around during the credits, which is another, like, just super famous Johnny Cash song. I picked American Six, which was the, technically it's like the third album that Johnny Cash recorded in studio, and then he passed away like almost immediately after doing all, like, putting all these songs on, recording all these songs, and he planned to release all of these like within certain years. So even though he was dead, he released him and his producer Rick Rubin, who's, you know, from, everybody knows Rick Rubin, mm-hmm. he's just like an incredibly talented producer and like songwriter, artist, all this other stuff, decided, they're like, okay, we're gonna release this box set this year, then we're gonna wait 3 years, release this one, and then this one. So all of the covers were from the Unearthed box set. I think it was like 5 discs or something insane like that. And then later was the God's Gonna Get Strike You Down one, which, if you saw the True Grit remake with, what's the guy from The Big Lebowski?
John Goodman.
That's it. No. So they had that song. That one's really popular now. And then, but this one was Ain't No Grave Gonna Hold Me Down. And like,
Ain't No Grave Gonna Hold My Body Down.
That's it. And so that song is the, not only is it the like title of the album, and then the album cover is just Johnny Cash's goofy face as a kid. It's like, that's the first track, and you listen to it, and it's so haunting.
When I hear that trumpet sound, I'm gonna rise right out of the ground. Ain't no grave can hold my body down. Well, look way down the river, and what do you think I see?
Because, first of all, he's singing this song about a grave not gonna hold him down, and this came out like 6 years after he died. And then they have like chains going on, it, like part of the instruments, and it's awesome. But you listen to this album, and it is so haunting, because it's just this old man singing about how he's been just crushed. And he actually sings a Kris Kristofferson song, which is a cool like tie-in with our pick for today.
You're welcome.
Thanks. But I first of all, love Johnny Cash. Super sad that he passed away. But unlike like the Bob Dylan reference I made earlier, like, he managed to put out, like,
he can actually sing?
First of all, yeah. I think so. Some people probably said he probably couldn't sing that well near the end. But I mean, like, he was doing creative new stuff. Like, he was doing weird covers of stuff. He does a cover of a Sheryl Crow song on this album. But, and like, and then he would go back and do some of his old gospel and country stuff. But I mean, he just did cool stuff. And he's like, well, you know, you don't need to hear more of my things. I'm just going to put my take on it. And I thought that's a real classy thing to do. So my recommendation is American Six, Ain't No Grave by Johnny Cash, who's dead. Just us in. Johnny Cash passed away.
We got some news coming on over the wire. Seems legendary country music singer.
Man in Black.
Old Blue Eyes. Johnny Cash.
Jamming to the Boy.
Who's dead? I like how you threw that in there. Mine was... I'm going to go with Milk and Honey, which is John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
Okay.
And...
they have a pretty crappy Christmas song. Is it on that?
You're not a fan of that Christmas song.
I don't like a lot of Christmas songs.
Yeah. You just don't like, you don't like anything that brings joy to people.
I
see you hesitated there for a second.
Because I thought agreeing with you would bring you joy, and I didn't want to do that.
Yeah, so. You didn't want to do that at all.
Never.
This guy, man.
Right?
You just... This guy nothing that brings...
Let's talk about dead people's music.
Yeah, that's nothing that brings anybody joy. But, no, it doesn't have Happy Christmas, War is Over.
Thank God. Maybe I would like it then.
So this is Christmas. And what have
Cut
you
it.
Done?
Cut this.
Cut his mic! probably the most well-known song on there is Nobody Told Me, which ended up... really, I think being the only like top five hit on the album. But the cool thing about this album is they did the album Double Fantasy together, mm-hmm. and this was supposed to be the follow up to that. But it was in the middle of when John Lennon had took like a 5 year like retirement almost from recording.
Which I don't know if you know this, like. They started dating when he was like 28 or mm-hmm. something. Just when you put everything in context, these people were so young. Mm-hmm. And when we think about them, like we think about them as like fully formed adults, mm-hmm. which is just probably not true.
Yeah. Just because he's got a big old beard and long mm-hmm. hair, you think he's like
and he acts
super
weird.
Old.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think this one was recorded when they were actually... had been separated for like 18 months.
And, wow, I didn't know that.
It kind of follows the same format that Double Fantasy did, where it would be like John Lennon on a song, Yoko on a song, Lennon on a song, Yoko on a song. And then, you know, together, of course. But mostly it was, you know, alternating tracks mm-hmm. between the two of them. And you could... Yoko actually finished all of her tracks on this, were fully, you know, produced and fully finished. Only a few of Lennon's were actually finished because he was killed
right.
during the recording of
Shot
this.
Shot outside of his hotel.
Yeah. So, you know, it was they were eventually, like, finished, polished up and put on the album. But, man, you really can hear... In Yoko's songs in particular, God, how just heartbroken she is. Mm-hmm. I mean, because these two, like, loved each other so much that, like, it broke up the Beatles,
right.
you know?
You know, just those guys.
Yeah, those losers. But, you know, you could just, it's just so passionate. She's so passionate on there. The thing that is, you know, is so interesting about this album is that you get to hear, you know, some of what, you know, John's going through right before he died, mm-hmm. you know, and that's just, that's so appealing to a lot of people
yeah.
to know what was, you know, what was going on in his life, because he was very reclusive
right.
at that, you know, when he was taking his break from recording.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm
You know, a lot of people wanted, you know, they just wanted to have anything that they could have, you know,
yeah.
that was John Lennon related.
That
they,
personal insight.
Yeah. Writing memoirs or anything like that. And this kind of gives you a little insight to what he was going through after ending the relationship with the love of his life. And her tracks are more finished, so
right.
you can hear, you hear a lot more out of Yoko, but you can get a lot, you know, out of what John was going through too, which I think is, you know, very cool given how another person who was taken too young, who knows what, you know, like I said, Paul McCartney's still selling out 60,000 seat stadiums.
And kind of like, he's still selling out too.
Yeah.
Like, John was going in an experimental direction because he wasn't comfortable with what his band had become, and he had a partner in crime on that, so it's just like, what could have happened?
Yeah, and it's the same thing with, like, Janis Joplin. You don't know what she could have done next. We don't know what John Lennon could have done next.
Right.
Who knows? Like, he was just a mad scientist of music.
Right.
Who knows what other stuff he could have came up with, or who he could be writing songs for today that Paul didn't do very often, right?
For the Beatles. And
and he wrote for, like, Badfinger or something like that, which was, like,
see, you're having trouble remembering, pretty well, so it's probably not that awesome.
But most of the stuff, like, that he wrote was for himself.
Yeah.
John Lennon is a guy who maybe he would have gone a different way. Yeah. Maybe he would have said, you know what, I don't want to make music anymore, but I love writing music, and can go with this artist who's, you know, doing a different thing and doing a different sound, and I can get my music, you know, out there in a different format or a different genre. But just the fact that how he died, and kind of it ties into, wasn't as young as Biggie and and Janis, but
Johnny Cash, as a like, they were contemporaries, that they got high a lot, you know, and like Johnny Cash took kind of like 20 to 15 years off of, like, performing, and then he came back as, like, an old wizened man, and he's just like, I'm gonna do some weird stuff, and it was awesome. And
people,
like,
loved it.
He sort of, like, fell off the radar for a while because he needed to recover. Like, John didn't get that chance. Who knows?
Who knows what can happen? And I guess that's, and maybe that's part of the allure of, like, an album like that. I guess it's just that it's
the less.
It's the what if concept of it. And maybe that's why, if people like Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin
would have. Bon Scott, singer of AC/DC.
Would have, you know, lived longer, maybe people would have. I don't think they ever would have grown tired of their act, but I think they would be less fondly remembered.
I mean, like Led Zeppelin, Robert Plant was a perfect example. Like, Led Zeppelin, people remember them as, like, a dynasty. They weren't around that long, you know, because John Bonham died, and they're all like, we can't still be a band, you know? Like, we'll come back and we'll play some Zeppelin songs, but let's all go in our own directions. And, like, they all went in unsuspecting directions, and look at look at the Rolling Stones, man. They're still putting music out. And Aerosmith, come on. Like, I don't want to hear that.
No.
Journey, just throw the towel in, bro.
And I think,
I don't know why I'm so bitter about it, but I am. That's my gut reaction is I'm bitter.
I know. I mean, it's the fact that Rolling Stones are still out there, and they're still selling out, you know, arenas and stuff, but not the same. As it was in their heyday.
And they're not trying to be new or good. They're just trying to be the same
just
that they were.
To, you know, capture the lightning. Cash in as much as we can. Because they're somehow still alive. Keith Richards, despite his best efforts, is still on this planet. So who knows?
Yeah. All right. So that was a downer. Sorry, guys. Yeah. We'll try to do artists.
So he's dead.
Yeah. Well, he's dead.
So she's dead.
They're all dead, man. And we'll catch you next week. Oh, no, we won't. Hang on. That's not a thing. Dan, how about some plugs? Dan, what do you want to plug?
I'm still doing my wrestling podcast, Rhino Wrestling Review, on iTunes and on InsideSTL.com and on YouTube, and you can find it everywhere. So if you like it, it helps me leave reviews. And
how can they contact you if they've got questions?
RhinoWrestlingReview@gmail.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Dan Rhino, DanRyno. And
just type it into iTunes and you can search your podcast?
If you just type in RYNO,
number one
hit, it should pop right up.
Awesome.
So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Also, Dan has a table at the Science Center every first Friday, and this drops the first of every month, so you can come in and see us.
Come in and say hi. If you're in the St. Louis metropolitan area.
At the Science Center. The next one's the Anime Explosion, so Dan will be up front.
So Dan won't be there.
Pokemon cards.
So Dan won't be there, so don't come by. If you come by, Dan won't be there.
Pokemon cards, but Yu-Gi-Oh!
For all our friends in Germany, fly on over and stop by. Say hi. I think
Wunderbar.
We kind of alienated the German fans, like, a couple episodes back. didn't we? But
Hans, is, he's going to get back to
the David Hasselhoff, like negative comments from David Hasselhoff.
But he sucks.
Sorry, bros.
All right, we'll catch you next time, guys. This has been Comparing Apples to Oranges with Mike and
Daniel.
We'll catch you next time. Bye.
Sell out with me, oh yeah. Sell out with me tonight. The record company's gonna give me lots of money and everything's gonna be alright.
Hello. I hope you enjoyed our episode, and the real big fish right there at the end to sort of boost our spirits after that downer. Thanks for listening. This has been episode 13 of Comparing Apples to Oranges. Look us up on Tumblr. We are Comparing Apples to Oranges. That's all one word, .tumblr.com. Check out the links there for my co-hosts and info about upcoming and past episodes. If you have any comments or ideas for future podcasts, that'd be great. Follow us on Twitter. We are at The Cato Podcast, all one word, or send those ideas via email to catopodcast@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our intro, outro, or music bed music, that was all Thumbs Up by the artist Leisure B, and if you liked what he was putting down, check it out. His stuff is at humanworkshop.com. All right, bye.